So thank you all for coming. This afternoon we'll have an exploration of the spiritual principles that really are part of community life. The topic actually says applying Yogananda's principles, but as Jyotish in the earlier class today said, that these aren't really Yogananda's principles. They're really the principles that he brought more into focus in this time of this new age. And so we'll be exploring different parts of those things. There are many, many parts, and we'll just cover a few here this afternoon. That Nyaswami Nitai will be focusing on principles that relate to education. Narayani will be talking about applying them to family life, and David will talk about the arts. And I'll start off talking about applying them to leadership. The operative word, the operative adjective with leadership that's important for us in community is the word supportive. That emphasis that we have with that really is the underlying fabric that allows us to be together, not only to get things done, because it's not a matter of driving people to accomplish things in a project or a community, but really how do we encourage that growth, that unfoldment, that potential in everyone? And that's a challenge. It isn't just we can have platitudes and understand the principles. There really has to be the meaningful integration where we really sense that. And guess what? That comes from a lot of different times of really blowing it, of just making a mess of things, and then moving forward from that point. Because when you gather anybody together, even just two people, as we've all encountered, and you grow that exponentially into a community, you know you've got a lot of, not only personalities, but a lot of opinions that seem to be the right way. As Haridas once said, I never knew there were two God's will until I was with this other person. And so what does that really mean for us? How do we really explore that? How do we really know that? By the way, I want to mention before I go on further that after about an hour, after each of us doing a presentation, we will have time for you to ask questions of any of us. And hopefully there'll be answers as well. But if you think about leadership and you think about that word supportive, it's really about how we open up to the deepest sense of who we are, first of all, that we become that centered expression of the divine. The more we have that in place, then we can feel that being able to reach out to other people and support them. But the danger then is waiting to the point where we're perfect to help other people. We think it's the blind leading the blind, and I think we've all felt that. But what we need to do is secure the attunement to going in the right direction. When we have that established, when we feel that's in place, then we need to explore how to encourage and how to really give the support for others to come to that same direction. Because if we talk about specifics too much, then we have that goal orientation that can easily supersede this important principle that people are more important than things. It's so easy, as we all know, when we get really caught in trying to accomplish something, there's a project, there's definite things that need to happen, maybe there's a deadline with time, and we feel that pressure, and it's real. It's not as if it's, you know, imaginary. In the circumstances that we're involved in, it's very real. But if we can pull back and feel, with the energy around me, starting from the energy within me, if I can put that in context of helping others, of service as the primary goal, then the project in its end result will work out, even if it won't be the way that we had thought it would be. And I think for many of us at Ananda, that's happened time and time again, where we see a project's goals, we see where we're headed, and by the time we're running down the road with the energy, it's moved differently. Because we're not static. We're not trying to be here and get there. We're trying to be here and encompass the entire experience that's already happening. When that comes down into working with other people, this principle that people are more important than things ultimately really creates that bond that allows success to happen. There are times, though, that we may then see the project shift completely in a different orientation because of that emphasis of people. Swami Kriyananda has talked about many times in the formative years of Ananda Village that throwing out an idea that he thought was very important needing to be shelved, at least for a time, for people to really come up to that and gain their confidence in moving forward with it. So the point isn't just to accomplish things, but you know, I mean, the reality is you do have to do this stuff as well. The kitchen has to get out its meal in time. You know, we can't say, well, whatever, Sri Ram, let's hope it works. We still have to have that reality check that that's going to happen. But if that team in the kitchen is given the confidence, the respect, the support, the energy, and the awareness, they'll come through. They'll come through with creativity that will allow that to happen, perhaps in a different way than someone else doing it. But it will be there because that endeavor is coming from their own spirit of wanting to do it, rather than, what do I have to do? How can I serve? You know, in meditation, an important emphasis that we place on the techniques and how we instruct people, especially in the beginning, is that we try to steer people away from this question of, what will I get from meditation? Which, again, is very normal. It's what I think most people will come to a meditation class with. And shift that into, what can I offer up in meditation? And that's the same shift that we work with in working with leadership and people. How do we allow people to come to that experience, being supported, where they're thinking, not only are they being supported, but how can they support other people? And so we look at what respect is. What does that mean? Well, you have to have in your own self, if you're a leader, that essence of respect. It's sort of like you have the aura of that integrated more and more in who you are. When you have that, then you can be respectful to other people. And often it can be reversed, that we grow in respect by being respectful of other people. So it's not a static position here. But in that respectfulness, people start to really appreciate their own worthiness of being an instrument as well. And in that worthiness, they can take much more responsibility, much more of an integrated part of that experience, again, not only for themselves, but for other people. So it becomes this cascading effect that allows more and more people to really embrace that experience. Because if we have kindness in that respect, if we have kindness in how we think and are with other people, even when the going gets tough, even when there's a difference of ways of looking at things, different opinions, we can see that within that difference, there's a spark of harmony that can further into cooperation in the outward way of expressing it. And that really is what has happened through Ananda's history, is that we found time and time again that when people really explore that of being kind to each other, respectful of each other, then it nurtures something that really is powerful. And that's that confidence of getting past the ego. The confidence of that there's more of God's presence within me that can flow through me to act. The second principle that we've used a lot at Ananda through the years is a saying from Bengal in India that Jato Dharma Tato Jaya, where there is adherence to Dharma, there is victory. And a way to understand Dharma, because the word Dharma gets thrown around a lot and many people understand it in various ways. If we think of it this way, that if there's adherence to the right principles through right action, then there is victory. So if we hold that up and we're not caught by the easiness of deciding to do something this way that undermines that Dharma, that principle of truth, then we will secure, not only for ourselves, but for the project, for the setting, for the people involved, really a sense of opening to self-fulfillment. And ultimately, that's why we're all here. You know, it seems like we can place so much importance on the things that we do. But ultimately, it comes down to that we're really growing ourselves. As I remember hearing this when I first arrived at Ananda in 1978, that there was this phrase, and I think it was coined by the carpenters here, the builders, that, you know, that not only are we building characters, but we've got a lot of characters. And we have really then that appreciation that we all are different. We don't have to toe the line. The danger in any group of people that grows in size is that does everyone have to fit the mold? You know, is Ananda here to make me like these other people? Well, yes and no. Yes, as a soul that's perfected in their experience of God. Yes, that's how we want to make everyone become. Not make everyone, but offer and invite that experience. But the answer is no if we look at it that everyone's going to be the same. The creativity gets stifled when we box people in. But when we can endeavor to really make that creative flow, and David will talk a lot about it, actually everyone will talk about this, but when we can endeavor to offer that possibility of supporting people's individual creativity, the empowerment that comes from that is amazing. And we start to not look at lines of authority as being the ultimate answer, but that there has to be leaders in a setting. And not so much that they're worth more in the setting, but that's their role to play. I remember reading the story that this young army recruit at an army camp was given the task of being the sentry guard at the entrance of the camp. And he was new. And he had strict orders that only those vehicles that had a special pennant would be allowed to enter into the camp. And so this car came up with a general and his driver, and the general waved on the driver to go past the sentry. And the sentry stood in front of the car and said, I'm sorry, sir, I'm new at this. Do I shoot you or the driver? So basically, it reflects that, you know, when we're really doing the right thing, we're doing the right thing. You know, we're trying to get past the hierarchy of things into what works. And so Swami Kriyananda has offered these two important things. What works when we're dealing with people in leadership? And then what is right? And it ties into people are important, and that, you know, where there is Dharma, adherence to Dharma, there is victory. And so in that, we start to realize that every moment of our days working with people, whether we're the person in the leadership position or whether we're not, we all need to develop leadership skills. Really, the leadership skills that we talk about are no different than the skills that we need as a devotee to grow, to nurture, to expand, to come to our highest potential, and to nurture that in other people. And so supportive leadership is saying, how do we make this work with those around us? How do we really see that the things that are happening, how do we support people in their growth? You know, it may delay things, it may shift things, it may make things awkward, but if we always hearken back to that, especially when the friction is there, you know, friction can be seen as the obstacle, you know, the thing that prevents us from really finding our fulfillment or achieving what we want to do, or friction becomes the springboard for us to grow. And typically that friction is going to come with people. And so what we can say is, okay, here's the situation. There's some friction here. There's some differences. There's some obstacles. What's the solution? What's the solution in the right way? Literally, we play that into what's happening. We ask it and we explore it. Because a lot of things that we're involved in may not be our expertise so much, and we may not know it. But we have access to a lot of other people, perhaps, or we have access to the possibilities if we open the door, things will come to us in that way. So a leader, in this sense, being supportive, may never get praise. So leadership isn't a position that we're going to receive something. It's more that we're in a position of giving, of offering. Not so much giving advice or that kind of giving, but offering. We're endeavoring to offer the best that we have to explore a superconscious solution by allowing people to grow in their own experience. And in that way, a spiritual community like Ananda, really everyone is a leader. Now, some people may not manifest that in their outward position. There are many people here, when I look around the community, that I see they're not necessarily in that position outwardly. But when I look at what they're doing in their lives, it may be the way that they garden. It may be the way that they dig a fence post hole. That the quality of leadership is still there because they're commandeering their energies and their awareness and their consciousness to go to the highest potential in them. And that's really what supportive leadership is about, is always coming from that perspective and nurturing in ourselves and in those around us that sense of, I can do it, being an instrument of the divine, letting God flow through me and really touching the highest in everybody and every situation. So thank you.
Four speakers and two microphones, so we have a little shuffling to do.
We're being supportive.
So for those of you who don't know me, my name is Nitai. Somebody asked me this morning if I had the class prepared, and I said, well, I've been preparing this for 40 years, because I had the Dharma to come in and start to work with education when I first came to the village. This upcoming year is actually the 40th year of the school. We're a couple of years behind the community. This you'll hear an echo, the same principles that Pranava was talking about. I'm going to just bring in and apply them because they're the same essence that applies in every situation in life. And it's more easy to see, though, in education because in some ways education is one of the last things to change. I was thinking supportive leadership is something, it's a concept that actually has been embraced to some extent in business. You see the Toyota model or the Hewlett-Packard way of doing administration. And they've been at least trying to incorporate some of these principles greater and lesser extent over the last 10, 15 years. In education, they seem to be going still the opposite way. maybe it's the attachment that parents have for their children. But for the last long time, education has been about preparing people to have a job. And it's like you start off, if you go to some cities, Seattle, San Francisco. I remember we were in San Francisco when my daughter was, she was about 3 or 4 when we went there. And some of the preschools there had a waiting list of 4 or 5 years, which meant that you had to run over to the preschool as soon as you knew you were pregnant and sign your kid up to get in. And why was that? Because that preschool had a history of getting kids into the right grammar schools, who had a history of getting their kids in the right high schools, who went to the right colleges, who got the right jobs, and that was the whole goal of it. It was basically to get the right job, to go to the right school, and to have the right credentials. As we heard Jyotishin Devi talking this morning, unfortunately that's the big flaw in Western culture, that happiness does not reside in those outward things. So we have a whole educational system that's basically racing as hard as it can in the wrong direction. It shows up most specifically in the, just over focus on test scores. There's just like everything's run by test scores these days in education. And people are fired, high schools are taken over by the state, all kinds of things happen if your test scores aren't up to snuff. And it's the test scores, what do they test? I did a little survey of this, the current California test is called STAR, and every public school child in California takes this test. It takes a week to administer the test, so you close down the school for a whole week and just do the test. And one of the questions for the fifth graders was, what's the role of the esophagus? And so if you don't know what the role of the esophagus is, you miss a point. There are approximately 150 other questions of equal purposefulness. There were probably other parts of the body you should know about or parts of, different things. It's all fact-oriented. It's all memory-type things. And it basically is all external. The challenge that we have with Ananda, the whole wave of Dwapara Yuga coming on the planet, is to change that around and say, You know, the basic idea is happiness is inside. Happiness comes in inside. Happiness comes from living a life where you can apply some of the principles that Pranava was talking about, where you can meet life's challenges in creative ways, where you can get the right set of challenges even. How many people go off and charging off in life and they get to the midlife and they say, well, what am I doing? Why am I doing this? What did I get out of it? You know, it's all too common. We had this story last week. A man was telling us about when he was 19 years old, he wanted to sail around the world. And he got it all together. He got his boat and he started sailing and he got all the way to New Zealand. And he realized that it was his father's dream, not his dream. And he didn't really care about finishing going around the world. And that was a challenge when he was able to switch. Fortunately, it happened at 19 years old. The man's very dynamic, doing what he wants to do in his life at this point. It's an interesting story I want to share from one of our graduates. This is a young woman who is pursuing a life as following her own, knowing what she wants to do. One of the main purposes of the school is to try to get kids to introspect enough so they know what is it you want to do. Where is your passion? Where is the thing that's going to really get your energy going and excel in that direction? And then the second part is give them the tools to be able to excel, give them the tools to be able to succeed in those directions. It's a little different. Some people think when they come here that the goal of a school here would be to raise devotees, to raise people who would want to stay at Ananda and meditate a lot, which would be a nice thing, but a lot of people aren't ready to do that in their life. And if they get into that too prematurely, they kind of limp along. There's no energy behind it because maybe they have some passion that they really would like to pursue, but they kind of are afraid to because they think, well, you know, maybe it's out there in the world and maybe I'll get in trouble. But the real goal of Education for Life is to help each student find that goal, whatever it is. It may be a short-term goal. It might be something that only takes 3, 5, 10 years to work at. But in the process of doing that dynamically, they're going to grow spiritually much more than if they try to bypass that and just try to say, well, that doesn't count. And just kind of try to sweep it under the carpet for a while. It's kind of a subtle point. It comes from the idea that how do you approach spirituality in education? Our culture doesn't do a very good job. We have, we have two models we work with. First model is if you think, how am I going to bring spirituality into education? You start having kids memorize things and start doing certain practices. And you try to dogmatize them. You try to cram them into a particular mold. And that's what the church schools have done over the centuries. It's just basically try to raise good Catholics or good Methodists or good Episcopalians. And the external part of it is emphasized. Like I tell a story sometimes. I went to Catholic grammar school for 8 years. And every year I got A's in religion. And every year I got further and farther from wanting to be a Catholic. Because none of it touched me inwardly. None of it actually made a difference to me as a person. The story I had is the most important experience I had in all those 8 years was in my eighth grade class when, as a kind of a terminally bored adolescent, we got involved with gambling in a Catholic grammar school. You know, we found a place where the nuns wouldn't go, which was the boys' bathroom, and we started bringing. We had poker chips, we had dice, we had cards, we had a whole casino. And eventually, somebody found out, and so we got hauled down to the principal's office, and she blasted us, all the reasons you would get blasted for. But our punishment was to have to spend the rest of our lunch periods for the rest of the semester inside. Our teacher had to join us in that, and our teacher, so she lost her lunch break too, which, you know, as a teacher, I can feel that compassion for her. But what she could have come in and she could have been really upset with it, but she came in and she said, all right, we have, I don't know, 3 weeks or 4 weeks here together at lunchtime. We could have choices. We could either be really angry and sad and mope around for 4 weeks, or we could try to make it a happy experience. And so she said, I have an idea. And we all said, what? And she said, let's put on a play. So she brought in this play script. She called it Pitch Black and the Seven Giants. And it was kind of the opposite of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, kind of emphasizing the darkness that we were. But the whole thing was done in a light way. We had such a joyful experience. I remember that to this day. It's like, she lifted the consciousness. And that's the most important thing I got out of 8 years of elementary school. But so the other option is, since we don't know what spirituality, we think everybody in the West thinks spirituality equals religion. So then the other thing is the public school approach, which just says no religion. And so that means no spirituality, no values, no anything. And you end up with, you know, handicapped kids who have no sense of what their spiritual aspect is of themselves or how to implement or how to cultivate it. So we're pioneering, Swami says, a revolutionary approach, which basically says, let's take these Dwapara ideas that spirituality is not dogmatic, it's not sectarian, it's just a universal part of who and what we are. It's impossible to separate it and still have a healthy person. You've got to include it. But what does it look like? It looks like values. It looks like learning about life from an experiential level, just like that the nun did with us. Well, you can have an experience of joy by doing this play. Well, we take a lot of values that are fairly well known, things like honesty, enthusiasm, self-respect, perseverance, strength of memory, things like this. I'm reading from a list of qualities called the Tools of Maturity Checklist. If anybody wants one after one, I'm happy to give it to you. But it's kind of a backbone of how we work with the kids in the school. But the idea is not to memorize these things, but it's to experience them and to try to help them realize that when you tell the truth, it feels different than when you tell a lie. And you might have to experiment with both sides to get the idea. You might have to tell a few lies before you can get the idea. But when you tell the truth, what happens? You feel a sense of integrity. You feel a sense of calmness inside. Mark Twain says, if you never tell a lie, you never have to remember what you said. So you can back it up. But then what happens when you tell a lie? Well, you feel nervous. You feel unsettled inside. What happens to the difference between the difference of sharing and the difference of taking? You know, again, you get a lot of experience like working with little kids. They don't come in. Most kids don't come in with the idea of sharing. Some do, but not all. And so you try to help them see that when they do share, yeah, there's a feeling that goes with it. There's an inner experience that goes with it. And again, when you take, there's another different kind of experience. It's not as doesn't create as much happiness. That's in introducing them to this whole idea that happiness is inside. And maybe you're learning it on just a simple way with those qualities, but it's a doorway that opens you up into the whole inner spectrum of experience that maybe later they'll want to ask who Patanjali is and what are the, I keep hearing about Patanjali. Who's that guy? What does he have to say? And then you say, oh, yeah, we could talk about Patanjali. We could learn about some of these other things, you know, non-attachment and devotion and the fact that there's a whole part of the spiritual path that has to do with the heart and the yearning for God and all those things and read about those people. But it's something you don't hit the kids over the head with just when they walk in the door. You want to cultivate that gradually and know when the right time to share it is. The school's been going on for 40 years. Like I said, the elementary school, it's grown. There's now elementary schools in Palo Alto, in Portland, Seattle, Assisi in Italy, and Gurgaon in India. We'll have schools starting fairly soon in Pune in India, and then somewhere in the near future in Los Angeles and other places. There are other schools that are somewhat like ours in different ways. We've had this contact with the City Ecologique community in Quebec in New Hampshire, and they have a school that echoes, you know, the same thing. These are universal principles. These aren't, like somebody said, these aren't Yogananda's principles or Swami Kriyananda's principles. They're people just can come into them from their own perspective and experience. We have the high school's been going, I think we're going into our 14th year in the fall. The college is going into its 7th year. And these are all parts of the filling out the education for life spectrum. We have great ideals and goals because we know that this is actually the answer to the problems of education in the whole world right now. We have people growing up in every single country who feel short-circuited by their education. wait a minute, something's missing. I didn't get something that really helps me in life. I didn't learn how to deal with other people. I didn't learn how to deal with failure. I didn't learn how to activate my perseverance, or I didn't learn how to become sensitive to other people's needs. All these things, there are thousands of them if you get into it. And a good education should embrace all of those and should cultivate those things. So we know what the world needs, and now the next phase for us is to get it out there. Because it is a worldwide shift of consciousness that has to happen. The schools, they're challenging to get these schools going. I see, Padma and Rose and different people from the school. It's hard because, why is it hard? Well, it's hard because of the same reason that Yogananda couldn't get a school started in Los Angeles back in 1920 when he wanted to. Parents didn't understand the value of this kind of education. They wanted, and we still get. I want to make sure my kid gets into Harvard. Or I want to, one very strange comment is, I need to put my kid in a place where he can really learn. He's having too much fun here. He can't be learning anything. And it's just like, they need a real education. And it's just that there's this mindset that is slowly changing. But we do have these schools started, and with perseverance, they are continuing and they're growing, and people are gradually seeing that they do work. So I want to close with just two little stories that kind of show some of this consciousness shift. So one of the graduates, I was talking to her the other day, and she was experiencing, she has a boyfriend, and she's going to go into a period of time, she's got to be away from the boyfriend. She was away from her boyfriend. And I said, well, how is it? And she says, well, I started to feel kind of sad about it this morning because I really miss him. And she says, but then I realized I don't want to waste a whole day being sad. So I'll think about him tomorrow. And I said, do you know that whole novels are written about that precious feeling of missing your beloved? And but for her, it was like, okay, yeah, I can do that later. But right now, I want to make sure this day is full. And that's a good fruit of an education for life education. And the other one was, this one has to do, has specifically with my daughter. My daughter is a career as a dancer. She goes all over the world dancing. And so she happened to be performing in Honolulu a couple of months ago. And her uncle on her mother's side happened to be visiting Honolulu. And so they got together for dinner. And this man, he's a very good man, but he spent his whole life trying to live by the book. You know, he graduated from college, he went into the military, served just whatever, 20 years, and got his pension and went into real estate and has done everything kind of the way you're supposed to do it to have a good life. And, you know, he was in Hawaii, so I guess that's one of the fruits of it. But so they're sitting down at dinner, and he says, Mirabai, he says, you know, it's really amazing that you're doing so well doing what you love. And my daughter looked at him and she says, wouldn't everybody want to do that? And his answer was just as impressive. He says, I can't afford to think that way. So with this approach to life, it'll be much, you'll see many more people following their inner passion of why are they incarnated here in this lifetime? What are they here to do? What are they here to accomplish? I see Lucian sitting out here. And when his daughter was in school a couple of years ago, and his daughter is an amazing runner. This girl is just world-class runner. And it was just so obvious that the most important thing for her was to find her a track to run on in a race so she could see how good she was. And so it was just like, okay, let's do that. So as this teacher, you have the whole gamut of the universe to sit there and try to figure out, what does this child need? Where do we go from there? Okay, thanks.
Can I just hold it? I don't have a pocket and it's too light. Thanks. Well, I was asked to talk about family life, and I thought, okay, 15 minutes, how do you talk about family life in 15 minutes? But I thought, for those of you who don't know me, I'm also a school teacher here. And there are two questions that come up again and again and again. So I thought, well, let's just kind of explore those two questions. One is, how do I balance my spiritual life with my family responsibilities? And the other is, how do we give these spiritual teachings to our children? And so, you know, if we look at how do you balance all those responsibilities that are part of family life with your spiritual life. And, you know, if you, before you become a parent and all of that, if you have, you know, you're used to hours and hours of meditation and all of that, you know, it's probably not going to happen when you have a little one. One of my, I remember when I was expecting my son, and a very good friend of mine, her son was about 3 weeks old. And she said, you know, I really thought I had renunciation down. You know, we didn't do a lot of entertainment. We didn't spend money on luxuries. We didn't do this. We didn't do that. And she said, but there were a couple of just givens that I assumed, like sleeping and eating. Just, you know, I sit down to eat, and the baby wakes up, the baby needs to be fed, then the baby needs to be changed, then the baby needs to be put down to bed. And you go back to that plate of vegetables an hour and a half later, and you say, what's the point? You know, or you lay down and you think, I'm going to get to sleep, and the baby wakes up, and the baby needs to eat, and the baby needs to be rocked, and the, you know, on and on. She said, there's nothing that you really just have to do. And I'm looking, thinking, oh, well, let's see. But the blessings that come from that, I think, you know, as I thought afterwards, I don't know what else in my life would have taken me to that kind of giving with such absolute joy. I mean, I really didn't care. But when I thought about, okay, so how do we balance our lives? And balance really is the key. But for in family life, it's not so much the form of the balance, but that balance is more of an attitude rather than a state of life. Because you may not be able, you know, before I was married and stuff, I had this really idyllic balanced life. It was so fun. I lived in this tiny little trailer, and you know, I'd race off to school every day. I was so excited to get to school. Those kids were like my family. I loved them. We had so much fun together every day. And I'd stay at school after they went home, and I'd finish all my schoolwork. And then I'd be so excited to go home because my little trailer, and you know, it takes 10 minutes to clean. And, you know, a banana and a container of yogurt, that's all I needed to eat. And, you know, it was quiet, and I could read, and I could meditate, I could listen. It was, everything was fun. Home was fun. School was fun. It was all fun. And, but it was a little bit of pretend life. You know, I had a lot of say in my life. And then, you know, to get, bring other people into your life, you can't do it that way anymore. You know, when there's a spouse, when there are children, you have to consider their needs and what's right for them. Excuse me. So when I said, when I say like balance is an attitude, you may not be able to get the outer form, but you can bring the attitude of balance into everything you do. If you bring the awareness of the divine into the cooking and into the chopping firewood and into the all the myriad of things that are part of family life, every single one of those things becomes a spiritual practice. If you can live with everything you do being one of your spiritual practices, it's a balanced life, because there's such a trap in, well, I need it to be this way. I need to be able to read an hour a day. I need to be able to paint once in a while. I need to be able to do 2 hours of yoga postures. Whatever that I need to do, well, that's wonderful if you can do it. But if what's on your plate doesn't allow it, then that's sort of not part of your spiritual practice right now. It's what's on your plate and what you bring to it. And then, you know, it's not looking outward, looking outward. I got to change this. I need it to be this way. But, oh my gosh, this is my gift right now. And so allowing the divine to express through you in the giving and in the receiving, both directions. And then those practices that we love and that feed us, when we get to do those, and hopefully, you know, you can carve out time, and it's constantly changing. You know, each new child changes the dynamic of the family. An older parent needs to come live with you, changes the dynamic of the family. All of that, that openness to flow with what it is and to ask, how do I live in a divine way in this situation right now? Because if that wasn't for us, that's not what we would be given. If we're given it, it's for us. So then switching, how do we offer this to our children? Because like Nitai was saying, they come in all different ways. There is no saying. When I grew up, my mom's here, so I matched with my parents. And so, you know, their values and the life that came from the values they lived made sense to me, and I wanted to live that way. And their guidance felt like wisdom to me, and I wanted to follow that guidance. So I came here thinking I knew how to do it. I knew how, you know, how family life should be, because what I experienced worked. But then I came here and I saw other people living, you know, guiding their families that way, and sometimes it was great and sometimes it wasn't. And then I saw other people guiding their families way different. And they had such secure, connected kids. I thought, how'd they get like that? It's not at all the way my parents raised me. And just recognizing that there's not a set way. It's what's in tune with the child that you have. You know, because some will be really physical, and some will be really heartfelt, and some will be, they need to understand before they can embrace it. And so the key is, how do we match with the child or children that have been given to us? There are a few sort of standard things that help. And that's at most, if you're talking about, you know, kids from real young to, you know, when they're teenagers, they're physical beings, they're feeling beings. And so, but they don't tend to be so much in their head. We as adults, we're inspired by words. We love words. And if we can be inspired by it, it like gets us going. But with kids, words stop them. You know, I know you've seen it. You're talking to a child and they just glaze over. You know, and but they're being people, you know, and so action and feeling is a big part of transferring our spiritual teachings to the kids. They need to do it, you know. So, like in school, there's every day we do something different. You know, whether it's mindfully eating a strawberry, first looking at it, feeling the little grains that are on it, the little seeds that are on it, put it in your mouth, roll it around your mouth, take one bite, taste what it's like, let the juice go down your throat, you know, or maybe it's a silent walk outside, or maybe it's a visualization, or maybe it's one thing we did at the end of the year that the kids were really, really liking, so I'd give them a pile of beans, and different, like three or four different kinds and a little blindfold, and with just their concentration and their hands, they would feel them. Okay, there's a lima bean, it goes over there. Of course, they didn't name it, but there it's in a garbanzo bean goes over here and a pinto bean goes over here, and just concentrating on something a little more subtle than their day-to-day life, you know, or listening to sounds in nature. all kinds of activities, some with movement, some with very little, some with a lot of concentration, some with more stimulation for those that need more stimulation. But all of it just trying to say, open this door, open this door, open this door. Which one do you choose to walk through? And even if they don't walk through in that moment, they've had those experiences, they've felt those feelings, and when the time is right, then they can walk through those doors that have been opened for them. Thank you.
So why don't we just stand up for a minute and stretch, and I'll get my cello for just a second. Question is, what kind of community? And we as human beings are born to be creative. We are born to sing. We are born to dance. We are born to make music. We are born to write. And the question is, in what ways of creativity what ways are going to lead us to that essence of Satchitananda, that true happiness that we're looking for? And if you look at the entertainment and the arts that we have today in this world, you can see that we're quite a confused lot of human beings. There are, as she says, a lot of doors that we can walk through. We can walk through this one of confusion. We can walk through this one of anger. We can walk through this one of lust and et cetera. But where's the one that leads us to happiness? Where's the one that leads us to this aspect of deep inner peace and the joy that we all are looking for? And this community here at Ananda is so extraordinary in so many different ways. And I'm sure each of us has attested to this fact. You know, for me, it's the fact that I walked in and heard the Ananda singers and thought, oh, how nice, this man, Swami Kriyananda, happened to write some nice songs. And the deeper I got into it, the more awed I became, the more my ego was able to be quieted down a little bit, the more I could fully appreciate and fully enjoy. And then I just said, okay, here I am, I'm ready to learn. And so with the arts here at Ananda, the question is, how do we use these arts? And it's just like the communities, how the communities aren't important in themselves. The arts are not important in themselves, but what is important is how they change our consciousness. And you'll see the self-importance of musicians or any artist for that matter. And there's something about it that you're taught to say, oh, he's a great musician, so you have to, yes, grant that respect to them, because that's what's expected. But yet there's some little part of you that says, well, I don't quite get it. I don't quite understand, or you're not completely thrilled by what they have to offer. And I remember my first time, I was very new to Ananda, and I played cello for the oratorio down in Palo Alto in 1997. And Agni Ferraro was conducting this 100 voice choir who just got assembled from all the different colonies. And he got the most amazing sound and vibration out of these singers without, hours and hours. Typically you spend hours of and days of preparation, and here he was able to bring these people together. And I soon realized that it's the attunement and the meditation and that everybody focusing in on an ideal that enables the message, that enables the inspiration to come out so powerfully. And I was just simply blown away, and very soon dedicated my life to finding out what this magic was all about and how we can possibly spread it even further. So, in fact, last night I was with, we have a, in Grass Valley, Nevada City, we have a Music in the Mountains festival, and they bring in a lot of professional musicians from the Bay Area and other places, and they have an orchestra, and last night I was invited to play one of the pieces for the Young Composers Concert, and so I got to, and the piece was by Keshav Abetz, who is a student here now down in Los Angeles, and I had the opportunity to once again intermix with my old colleagues, with the type of musician that I grew up with. And what a joy it is to work with singers here. I have the great honor of working with this music and working with the choir. People who have consciously said, all right, I want to dedicate my time and my energy to this work, because it just fills me with joy. And just, you know, when you have people like that, you can't have a bad evening. Every choir rehearsal that we have, we all just leave in an uplifted state of consciousness. Well, it can't be said of every musical experience out there in the world. And it was so sad to see that the typical musician is not... They don't have the opportunity to understand that their egos don't necessarily have to be there, or that the way their consciousness cannot help but be projected into the audience through the music, no matter what they're playing. And when you hear this choir, it's you hear not the individual voices, you hear their attunement to God's inspiration. And once again, these are universal principles and things that we work on all the time in our choir. In fact, we the aspect of harmonizing and blending our voices, we do an exercise where we all sing together, and we just sing, oh, we just make one single vocalization. And I say, okay, now I want you to listen to the person across the circle from you. And they're like, oh, how do I do that? And so it's gradually expanding their sense of awareness, albeit just with their ears, but also you then are stretching your aura, you're stretching your receptivity, and then I say, okay, everybody back up. So we widen the circle and widen the circle and widen the circle. And so it trains us to not only be aware of ourselves, but also bring in the awareness of others. And that's what we do in leadership, that's what we do in the schools, that's what we do in our family lives as well, is to expand our awareness through these principles. Being able to feel ourselves in others, to be able to have, what's the, this maturity? Is To be able to relate to other realities other than your own. And so with the arts here at Ananda, we have this incredible opportunity not only to sing beautiful music, but to sing beautiful music that attunes us all together. And so we happen to sing the music of Swami Kriyananda. And you know, my first, oh, how nice this man happened to write some music. And, you know, on the outside, it seems very simple, some of the songs. And my sophisticated mind said, oh, poo-poo, yes, this is very sweet. But I know. And then I started to dive deeper into these songs and had these profound experiences that just shook me to my foundations, because here was something very simple melody. It wasn't sophisticated or, you know, deep harmonies or filled with angst. It was just a happy song. How could a happy song make me feel so happy? Or, you know, what am I looking for in life? Well, this is part of it. And I was experimenting just this other day with going back and forth between classical music of, say, Bach and some of Swami's music, and it just astounded me how this music just made my heart very calm, very open, and in ways that classical music isn't designed to. And then it's like classical music is not designed, these past 300 years were not designed for necessarily upliftment of consciousness. It's more designed for entertainment value and stimulation, and especially in this past 100 years, a lot of confusion in this, like, well, I'm filled with angst and I'm going to express my angst through this music, and, well, you know, what good is that going to do any of us who are looking for happiness and peace and joy? So the music that we have here at Ananda was born of service. Swami Kriyananda thought, well, if there was only a way that I could express these teachings through music, bing, he got his first song fully composed, just like that. He has a tremendous gift, just like Mozart, of being able to tune in and ask for a melody, and there it is. And the more I play his melodies, even unstructured ones or unharmonized ones, there's a certain rightness to them. There is, yes, that is the right note to express this element of joy, this element of happiness. And so I wanted to give you an experiment of, or showing you an example, rather, of attunement to higher values. And every successful community is going to have an attunement to some higher reality or some higher ideal. And when you're in tune with that, that's what I love about these teachings, in tune, attunement, everything resonates within you. And to demonstrate that, I'm going to play my open D string, and then I'm going to play a note that is slightly off. So I'm going to play that note. And you can hear as I play them together a sense of discord. And you can even feel within you a sense of that tension. And there's what happens is the sound waves are interfering with each other. And where they meet up, there are these pulses. And as they get closer and closer, those waves start to settle down and get slower and slower, until it kind of sounds like a helicopter, like a wah, 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 wah. But then when they come into tune, perfect attunement with each other, they start amplifying each other. And we do this in choir all the time. Two people are singing slightly off, their voices will fight against each other. But when we all blend together, then it amplifies the sound, and it amplifies our hearts and our feelings. So this aspect of attunement is incredibly important in the arts. If we are singing a song, what are we attuning ourselves to? If we are dancing, what aspect are we trying to express? What are we trying to attune ourselves to? If we are being creative, what aspect of a higher ideal are we trying to express through our painting, our writing, our drama? And so the arts here are not for art's sakes. There are other communities that are very arts centered, and they venerate the arts of that. Now, there is an aspect of that which is worth consideration, in the fact that every great piece of music has at its birth a spark of divine inspiration. Brahms wrote said in an interview that when he composes, he goes into a superconscious state. And it wasn't a subconscious and it wasn't a conscious, but more of a superconscious state where he touched that aspect of the divine. And it is my personal dream to be able to help people be able to tap into that more and more, instead of just, I'm going to play these notes as best as I can. You know, you get there, and we've all seen the musicians who have great technical ability that you have to applaud, but they left you feeling not very inspired. Versus, you know, people that you can tell their heart is just so connected. They'll miss notes, but you say, oh, I love their performance because they just have so much to give. And here at Ananda, people are truly more important than things. With our choir, we are becoming more trained. We are, thankfully, being able to work with more and more vocalists like Ramesha, who come in and work with us and give us excellent tips on how to sing. And that is helping us. But our technique is never the end all be all. And in fact, whenever I, as a conductor, be like, okay, now stop, we have to get this note in tune, we have to get that note in tune, we'll struggle for 20 minutes, and then I'll remember, ding, go back, sing just a melody, feel the inspiration, sing it again, go deeper in that inspiration, and immediately everything fixes itself. In the inspiration that we have to work with here is intelligent. It is something that shows us how we can all express it to its greatest fulfillment. And so what I wanted to close with is, once again, the fact that we are all vibrational beings, and our arts here are, the purpose of our arts is not to be like, oh, look at us performers, you know, or to, you know, create our own ego vortexes, but rather to express our inspiration and hopefully touch the hearts of those who are able to listen. And I wanted to show you how that works. So on a physical level, if I play my note D down here, I don't know if you can see, but my upper two strings are vibrating while I play this note, because they say, oh, I am in tune with that note. I'm going to start vibrating like that. It's to my little kids, I say, it's the cello angels that are, you know, helping you play those notes. But it's something that is divinely mysterious, this aspect of sympathetic resonance. So if it can work on the physical level, it can also work on our vibrational level. If the choir is able to convey joy, if they are able to vibrate dynamically with joy, with happiness, with peace, with love, then that is going to strike a chord in our audiences. And that is truly our highest dharma here as musicians, as dramatists, as actors, as painters, is to help bring about this change of consciousness that is so sorely needed in this world. So.
This is a question for Nitai. You were talking about the esophagus and what's the role of the esophagus. And I know that our children test very, very high on test scores, and yet they're having lots of fun. How do you explain how they can do so well on these tests?
Good question. It's interesting that, I guess, one of the kind of flawed approaches of Western education, it's very similar to the flawed approach of Western nutrition or food preparation. So if you go back to 1945 and you look at what was on the shelf in the supermarket, there was a lot of farmer's produce that came in off the farm, and it was probably pretty fresh and had a lot of nutrition. Somebody got the idea that it would be better if it was like the tomatoes were a little bit redder and a little bit bigger and a little bit rounder. And so they started playing with agriculture so you could get red, big, fat tomatoes. And that would last longer. They wouldn't, decompose on the shelf. And they succeeded. So we come into the 70s and 80s, and we have all this great stuff in the supermarket that looks fabulous. It never rots. But the problem is it has no nutrition. It doesn't taste good. And so there's this whole reaction or wave of organic gardening that comes in where people think, oh, we got to get back. We have to learn how to treat these plants in a full way, and then we'll get back to those other values we lost. Well, it's exactly the same thing in education. People got somehow got into the idea that it's this test score stuff that we need to get. And we're going to push these kids to get these better and better test scores, and we're going to push harder and harder. And so what we got is, I'm not even sure we've improved the test scores, but we got a lot of kind of kids that are, you know, on the brink of going having nervous breakdowns and sometimes going over that overboard with it. So the same thing is true in education, a balanced education, such as Education for Life, where you have lots of great music and all kinds of other things happening, drama, service projects. You know, the whole child's being cultivated. Voila, we get good test scores. So I just happened to bring today. This is a little handout if anybody wants one afterwards. These are the current scores that we have from the high school. That the first one is the SAT, which is the big test that most people in the United States take to get into college. And on an average, our students score 1,706 is their total score. The national average is 1,511. So it's almost 200 points higher. And this, we're not hand-picking our kids that go to take the test. These are just anybody who wants to take the test takes it. We do another kind of test every year. This is because we went into the accreditation process a few years ago, and we started off for their sake, and we realized, oh, my gosh, this is for our sake, too, because it's going to help answer a lot of questions. So we picked out a test that doesn't ask if what the esophagus does, but it does it does ask if you know how to read, if you can read well and understand what you're reading, if you have a good vocabulary, if you can do English grammar, if you can do math, all the basic things that we do value. And these are the average percentile scores for the last 5 or 6 years. Percentiles mean that, if you're not familiar with them, it's on a basis of 100 randomly picked schools. Where would your school place? And if you're at the 50th percentile, you'd be right in the middle. You'd be right an average school in the country. So our score is 2005, we were in the 96th percentile. 2007, 90th. 2008, 94. 2009, 93. 2010, 93. This year, 98. And it's just, we don't even concentrate on this. it's just the natural fruit of having kids that enjoy being in the school, that you don't waste 2/3 of your period disciplining kids. You can jump right in and you can learn. We only have math 3 days a week. We have most of our solid courses are only 3 days a week, and every other high school that I know about, it's 5 days a week. But 5 days a week, you get a little tired, and you start to resent being there. 3 days a week, you can gear up for it, and you can try to do your best. And but plus, of course, a lot of the education is individualized, so you do get the test scores that you want. We haven't had anybody apply to Harvard yet, but we have had kids get into the next layer level down, which is places like Mills and Lewis and Clark and Berea, places like that, which are excellent schools, highly competitive, and the kids do really well. One of the guys is at Chico State right now. He got in the honors program as a freshman. He was given an honor as the top person in the honors program, which meant he was basically the top student in his whole freshman class. So you have a lot of obvious fruits of it. It's not that we're against academic achievement. It's just that we just think it fits in much better in a broad basis of things. Thanks for asking. Ronnie actually has taught in the school more years than I have.
Another thing to it is that there's not a trick to it, but when you give kids their studies in a way that they can joyfully receive them, if they're little and you give them their studies in stories and in games and in physical activities, they're going to take it in. And you don't have to go over it again and again and again. Because, if I asked you to tell me the basics of Pinocchio, probably you could tell me the basics of Pinocchio, even if you only heard it, once or twice. Because it speaks the language of childhood. And so they take it in and they retain it. So the test scores are going to be higher because what we give them, they can digest.
I've been hearing some discussion over the last couple days about how a lot of the kids that grew up here, they haven't stayed here. A lot of them have left, and there's another community, Cité Écologique, where a lot of them have stayed. And, you know, they were talking about, well, maybe that happened because of this, and maybe that happened because of that. And you were also talking about tuning in to each child. And I was just curious if there are things that we would need to do to work to improve that, or if it's really more of our karmic design that that's how things got laid out here. Yeah. Well, any of you.
You know, I think it's kind of both. We're learning. Like in Cité Écologique, they were the whole basis of the community, was the school and the children. So everything, in fact, the principal of one of the schools there was talking a few days ago, and everyone's schedule is even designed so that in accordance with what's going to serve the children. And if this child needs extra help in this area, who can free up their time to do it? You know, so there's a huge emphasis in that. And of course, our community has many, many outreach areas. But we are learning, and we are learning from them as far as how to bring our young people more so that they feel like this place is theirs. You know, ours is strongly ministry based, and so it's hard. You can't really take someone who's very young and just really entering into the spiritual path and put them out in a big ministry way, you know. But a business, absolutely. They bring such freshness. They bring new ideas. They're not boxed in. So that we can learn from them a lot, you know. They're learning from us, even though, you know, I was saying as far as family life, you know, you have to adjust even your spiritual practices as much as you don't want to. It's not to say we don't meditate. I think every parent here does everything they can too, but there will be times when it's more and there will be times when it's less. They're looking at us and going, how do you do it at all? Wow. You know, we can learn from you that aspect of life. So it's a real nice blend that's happening. But also, we really, just like Nitai was talking about his daughter and who goes around the world dancing, you know, it's part of our spiritual teaching that we each have our own journey, that we each have our own way. And we want everyone growing up here to be able to express themselves and their potential as fully and in as much development as they possibly can. And if and when the time is right for them to say, "This, I choose this too," then that's perfect. To do it early, if it's not coming from deeply within you, it's, you're not going to embrace it with the same passion that when it's like, this is what I want. So, you know, we're learning still and growing and changing, but there's also just that sense of an honoring the rightness of each one's journey.
I just want to actually add something to that comment. I think for the kids that grow up who then have a dharma or a mission in the world, they take everything they've learned from spiritual community and the embodiment of that, and that's their service. And so they're going out and they're dancing from that spiritual perspective, and they're showing how you can be in the arts and be in that place of peace and from that spiritual perspective. So I wouldn't think of it as we've lost some people and they kind of went out there. It's that they're all, you know, our emissaries are...
I have a strong interest in dance myself, but it's in an area that even though I'm a strong meditator, and it's Latin dancing. And some people would say that that is not spiritual, or how do you bring God into that? To me, it's a very joyful and spiritual practice. It is a practice. And I was wondering if the people here who have experience with dancers or in the arts could say something about the spiritual aspect of dance.
We both have daughters that are dancers, but his is a little younger. Oh, gosh. It has to be tied into the individual and their expression. I've watched my daughter dance for 25 years, basically, and whatever form that she's doing, I find inspiration from it. Now, of course, I'm prejudiced. But there's more to it than that, that there's a way to approach any dance that can give an uplifting vibration, and there's a way to approach dance that can pull the energy down. And so hopefully somebody who, in fact, I've had many conversations with my daughter over the years as she's tried out different dance forms, is like, just how do you approach that? What are you looking for? How come you do it that way? And so there comes back to this sense that there's a sense of upliftment or inspiration that can come that she's trying to tune into and trying to get it, not only in her own dance, but in teaching. She teaches a lot too. And then I've watched that too. She'll teach people. And at the end of the lesson, these people are smiling. These are people, they've been uplifted, even though they were just in a dance lesson, which you think maybe wasn't. But the way that it was done brought their energy up. So it's definitely possible. It depends on the consciousness of each person that way.
That's a wonderful question, and in fact, I had to work with that myself. I was very new on the path, and I ended up playing in a band that did a lot of Latin music, and my disciplinarian within myself, no, you must not enjoy, this is bad, it's taking away from your inner peace. But I realized that here I was, this is my karma to be worked out, and I might as well figure out the best way to go about doing that. So I would then work with the joy of creating music that might not be the most inward, might not be the most meditative, but to tap into the joy of expressing that happiness. And there is, however, that danger of the energy going outward and balancing that with, okay, we've felt the joy. Now, what are you going to do with that? Are you going to go looking for more joy and more joy and more, going outward and outward and outward? Or do you take that and then bring it in and say, okay, God, I will feel your joy dancing through me. I love Chariots of Fire. Through running, I feel God's joy when I run. And, for some people it's that. For some people it's dancing. For some people it's playing the cello. I mean, but I think it's dangerous to squelch things that you don't think are supposedly spiritual, but also not to put any discrimination on your energy. So enjoying it with God's joy, and then taking that joy deeper and deeper and expressing that as best as you can. And, the great artist like Michael Jackson, you can tell he was so successful because he just expressed that joy, and he was so dynamically in that state that you enjoyed watching him. You can't take your eyes off people like that because they are just so alive with energy, with God's joy, with energy. So it all comes out very different, and it's very easy to put on labels of this is spiritual and that's not spiritual. And so there is joy to be had in everything, I believe. So.
Hi. Okay. Thank you, panel. Nitai. Yes, you talked about, the traditional educational models use diagnostics to measure or to determine what children know and learn. Can you say a little bit about what your students actually learn, and how would you go about measuring that or determining that? Because these are very ephemeral kinds of things, happiness and success and...
It's a nice talk. This is Nefertiti, if you don't know Nefertiti. Nefertiti is one of the new teachers in the college, and she has a Harvard degree. In fact, she... Oh, sorry. Howard, okay. She told me the story, though, about going through it. Howard is a very well-known school, too, and the getting the degree and kind of looking at it and say, is this all? Sorry. So I've talked a little bit about the cognitive side of things, which is those test scores that I talked about previously. But one of the things that we've been challenged to do, again, by going through this accreditation process for the high school and now for the college, is to show them how do you measure that kids are actually growing in these other ways. So we've worked really hard over the last few years to come up with a diagnostic tool that will start to, and it's been a constant refinement. Sometimes I feel like a little bit like Michelangelo trying to work on a sculpture. It's like, oh, and then you come over here and you change it and then just keep trying to get the whole thing. It's a long, long job. Anyway, what we got right now is it's called a Tools of Maturity Checklist. And it's implemented in different ways with the different age groups. Like, I actually didn't get a chance to talk to Narani about this yesterday because one of the newest little insights was from talking to the City of Ecologique people is we should sit down with the parents in the fall and go over the checklist with the parents and decide on a particular path for the fall, for the school year, and then we'll just keep in track. We'll keep changing notes, and we'll be able to show it. So basically, we start off with find out which qualities are you're ready to work on, and then score yourself on a scale of 1 to 10, one being you don't do very well in it, and 10 being you've got it, you've mastered it. And again, some of the examples would be gratitude, cleanliness, diet, courage, reasoning ability, things like that. So there's a whole bunch of them, and you could create other ones that aren't on the sheet. You choose maybe two or three that you want to work with, and then you just keep working with the child with that way. You just kind of remind them. You don't want to over-remind them, but you want to keep them focused on it. And then you keep looking at it. If they're younger, you might be great. You're checking it for them. If they're older, they're going to be self-assessing. And then they also get a weekly or however often you're checking a grade for effort. And the effort comes in colors. So if you tried really hard, you get a purple. And if you didn't try, you forgot to try at all, you get an orange and things like that. So you have two different phases. And then at the end of the year, you look and you see, where are you? Well, we did the initial thing this last year. We still weren't completely scientific about it, but we were able to show that at the college level, at least, that people were able to move up two standards within the 1 year. Like they started at a 5, they ended up at a 7 on an average basis, or a 3 to a 5. And so this is the kind of way. It's a hard because it's obvious when you watch people. You could say, oh, that person's really grown. Like you look in their eyes. I was like, if we could have a light meter measuring the amount of light that comes through people's eyes, it'd be easy because people walk in and they're kind of like, you know, and by the end they're like this, you know, and it's like it's really, really clear. So, but I don't know how to measure that yet. So this is the way we're trying it right now, and I think it'll go well. I think it'll make it clear that's. This is kind of the basis for the college getting accredited as the next step. The college has three big milestones this spring. We got, fortunately, they came in this particular order. First of all, we got recognized by the Veterans Administration, of all people, as a viable place for them to pay us to educate veterans, which who would have ever expected that? Out of all the bureaucracies in the country, the Veterans Administration would have. But it did. So they came out and okayed us. Second thing is the state of California, after having our application sitting on the desk for 5 years, finally got around to saying, yes, you're qualified to offer a bachelor's degree or an associate of arts degree. Fortunately, that came because 4 weeks later, we gave our first bachelor of arts degree, which we probably would have done anyway, but at least it was legal. And it was but authorization to give a bachelor's degree, while it is a huge step, where I think there's only like 4 colleges in north of Sacramento in California that can give a bachelor's degree, and we're one of them. So it's a big step. But the next step is accreditation, which means can you take that bachelor's degree to Stanford, and they'll put you in their master's program. And that's the process we just are starting right now, and that this checklist is a big part of trying to prove that we do have a viable alternative. So hopefully work. Thanks.